This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. An extraordinary hearing is taking place on Capitol Hill in the Senate Judiciary Committee with Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Blasey Ford, the woman who accused him of sexual assault.
Both Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh have been through a terrible couple weeks. They and their families have received vile threats. What they have endured ought to be considered by all of us as unacceptable and a poor reflection on the state of civility in our democracy.
What I find most inexcusable is this rush to judgment, the unwillingness to take these kinds of allegations at face value and look at them for what they are, a real question of character for someone who is asking for a lifetime appointment. The entire country is watching how we handle these allegations. Is Brett Kavanaugh who we want on the most prestigious court in our country? Is he the best we can do?
I am here today not because I want to be. I am terrified. I am here because I believe it is my civic duty to tell you what happened to me while Brett Kavanaugh and I were in high school.
As was predictable, and as I predicted, my family and my name have been totally and permanently destroyed.
I have seen my life picked apart by people on television, on Twitter, and in this body who have never met me or spoken with me. I am an independent person and I am no one's pawn.
A Democratic senator on this committee publicly referred to me as evil. Evil.
It is not my responsibility to determine whether Mr. Kavanaugh deserves to sit on the Supreme Court.
You sowed the wind. For decades to come, I fear that the whole country will reap the whirlwind.
My responsibility is to tell you the truth.
And then the questions began.
How are you so sure that it was he?
The same way that I'm sure that I'm talking to you right now. It's just basic memory functions.
So what you are telling us is this could not be a case of mistaken identity.
Absolutely not.
Dr. Ford, with what degree of certainty do you believe Brett Kavanaugh assaulted you?
100%.
What is the strongest memory you have? Strongest memory of the incident? Something that you cannot forget? Take whatever time you need.
Indelible in the hippocampus is the laughter, the uproarious laughter between the two, and they're having fun at my expense.
Amy Sabrin is a retired partner from the law firm Skadden Arps, where she represented many public officials and executives in DOJ and congressional investigations. I spoke with Amy before Kavanaugh started his testimony. Amy, thanks for being with us.
It's nice to be here.
So I had a really, you know, we were going to sort of take this as a straight news hit. And I just have to say, as a woman sitting here listening to that testimony, I think it would be lacking in transparency to say that I wasn't impacted by that. I know I'm watching social media and there are women who are saying they're not even watching because this is so painful. What are you hearing from women that you're talking to today when you're not talking to us on The Takeaway?
I'm hearing that she is coming across as incredibly authentic and credible. And when that moment that you just played, when she testified that her most indelible memory of the incident was, I think she said, I was underneath one of them while the two laughed, two friends having a really good time with one another, was, sort of a stop heart moment in her testimony.
Were there other things that stuck out to you so far? I mean, this is an obviously a developing story, but just hearing what we've heard so far.
Yes, I thought it was significant that she elaborated. I guess she had referenced this in her letter, but it wasn't entirely elaborated on until this morning, that her goal when she first contacted her congresswoman in California was to try to alert authorities to the assault that she says occurred, and to head off Brett Kavanaugh's nomination before he was selected so as to avoid emotional harm to her family and to his, and also to give the president the opportunity to choose another qualified candidate from his list of conservative jurists. So that underscores that she didn't really have a political motive in it. She was, as she said, trying to do her civic duty.
So we mentioned Rachel Mitchell, who's the attorney that the Republicans hired to go through this. And she's going through every account that Dr. Ford has given of the assault. What's the strategy here?
Well, the strategy is for the 11 Republican men on the committee to not have to touch this. I think Rachel Mitchell seems to be doing a very professional and systematic job. It has been so far a gentle cross-examination, but it is a cross-examination. It doesn't quite fit into the format where each senator gets 5 minutes to question, first a Republican and then a Democrat. And Rachel Mitchell's cross-examination is being broken up into 5-minute chunks. And so it doesn't really work in this format very well, but it is succeeding in its main goal, which is to let the Republican senators avoid questioning Dr. Ford.
Well, so I want to also talk about the language there. You said cross-examination, right? And we heard Senator Feinstein say that this is not a trial. It's a job interview, essentially, for Brett Kavanaugh. I'm wondering why it's increasingly difficult to see the difference between that. Dr. Ford is not on trial.
That's correct. And, so that's another issue about choosing a prosecutor to question her in this fashion. Although, I do think Ms. Mitchell is doing a very professional and systematic and respectful job of it.
What about how the Democrats are using their time? How would you assess them so far?
I think they're using it very effectively. I don't think they're doing too much grandstanding. And I think they recognize that in this witness, Dr. Ford is very capable, and she was obviously visibly upset as she was reading her opening statement, and you could hear it in her voice when you played those excerpts. But she is listening very carefully to the questions and responding appropriately and carefully, and comes across as, a strong person, actually. And I think the Democrats are recognizing that, so they're not spending a lot of time scoring political points against the Republicans about not calling the FBI and so forth, but they are giving her an opportunity to speak.
Yeah, we've talked to some other folks about what to expect today. And one thing that, as we mentioned earlier, this is not a criminal trial for anyone. A lot of folks have said this is about perception. How is Dr. Ford doing if that's the case? And is this more about perception, or is it about the facts, or both?
Well, I think it's about both, but I think in this case, perception is probably overriding, and I believe she's doing very well in that regard. I think she's leaving them with a choice of, as one woman I was talking to about this said just a few minutes ago to me before I came on the air, that they can choose. It's hard to choose not to believe her. The best that they can hope for is that it's inconclusive as to who to believe. I'm not sure I'm making sense in that regard, but I think the Republicans have made a political calculation before this hearing began. They think on the one hand, if they plow through it and put him on the court, women voters will be enraged and the Democratic base will turn out in droves in November. But if they pull his nomination, their conservative base will be enraged and will probably not turn out. And either way, there'll be a blue wave election. So they think they might as well salvage something from this and put this conservative on the court before the election.
We're also hearing a lot in the hearing about Kavanaugh's friend, Mark Judge. He's also been indicted in these accusations. Why is he not a part of this?
Well, I can only speculate about why the Republicans are so hesitant to call him. But as you've probably heard, Mark Judge wrote a book about his teenage years in which he describes a lot of drinking and a lot of debauchery. And they just don't want him to be a witness because then he will be questioned about that and it would further degrade his friend Brett Kavanaugh's reputation.
And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about during the hearing so far about Dr. Ford's request for an FBI investigation. It's come up repeatedly. In your legal opinion, should there be an FBI investigation into these allegations? And with a vote scheduled for tomorrow, I'm wondering, I mean, it seems rather unlikely at this point.
There should have been, and there normally would have been. Not only have I represented witnesses in congressional investigations, but I actually vetted some Supreme Court candidates for prior presidents, for President Obama. And it's standard operating procedure. And the FBI could have pretty expressly handled this and gotten through at least some of the main witnesses and figured out what we could know for sure and what we couldn't know given the passage of time. And I think if they had started it from the beginning of this process, it probably would have been concluded by now. And it would have been in Judge Kavanaugh's interest and in the Supreme Court's interest that done.
We do know, Amy, that there was, when we talk about Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas, which is something that people are talking about quite a bit with this hearing, that there was an FBI investigation at the time for that situation. What's different today with what we're seeing because of the comparisons with Anita Hill?
Well, I think that's why you're seeing Rachel Mitchell do the questioning. That's one thing that's different. I mean, I've never been involved in a hearing where senators ceded questioning in such a high-profile matter to a staff attorney outside of an investigatory kind of setting. That's the biggest change. And I think also the sensitivity at first to not calling Dr. Ford a liar came out of the Anita Hill hearings.
And, you know, when we look at this, I mentioned earlier, we've got about 30 seconds left. We're having this in this Me Too moment. Do you think that's had any impact, any effect on the overall tone and the way this is being received by the American public?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think a lot of women of any political stripe are just angry. They're tired of being told how they should think and feel about sexual assault, why they should have come forward or not come forward. And I think the Me Too movement has, to use a 60s phrase, raised some consciousness about these issues.
Amy Sabrin is a retired partner from the law firm Skadden Arps, where she represented many public officials and executives in DOJ and congressional investigations. Amy, thank you for joining The Takeaway.
You're welcome.
I truly wish I could be more helpful with more detailed answers to all of the questions that have and will be asked about how I got to the party and where it took place and so forth. I don't have all the answers and I don't remember as much as I would like to. But the details about that night that bring me here today are the ones I will never forget. They have been seared into my memory and have haunted me episodically as an adult.
As the country turned its eyes to the tumultuous confirmation process of Judge Brett Kavanaugh, the culture of Washington, D.C. itself has come under new scrutiny. The Capitol is sometimes described in, well, unflattering terms by the rest of the country. And that Washington bubble, that elitist boys club that values and uplifts men in politics and not women, well, there's some truth there. And that's according to my next guest, who was in the center of it all back in the 90s and has watched D.C.'s evolution when it comes to men, women, and power. Ambassador Carol Moseley Braun is a former U.S. Senator from Illinois and former U.S. Ambassador to New Zealand and Samoa, and she was also the first female African-American U.S. Senator. I asked her why she decided to run for Senate back in 1992.
Well, our incumbent senator, who I knew, actually, had announced that he was inclined to vote for the Supreme Court nomination of Justice Clarence Thomas. And this was at a time in my life when I was particularly struck by the difference between the Thomas nomination and Thurgood Marshall and the Warren Court, because my entire life had been made possible by the Warren Court. And so I was annoyed that he didn't understand why this was not a good thing, and that my constituency, my community generally, was upset about it. And he just didn't seem to get it. And so I decided to run for the Senate. I was qualified for the job, and I won. I wound up winning because this other guy came into the race and spent a gazillion dollars of his own money, and that made the difference. And, of course, women were so, at that point, upset about the way Anita Hill had been treated in the hearings, and so I got a boost from that. And I won the statewide election, and it was a breakthrough.
And, of course, when you arrived in Washington, did you have any initial impressions of the city or its people?
Other than vortex of evil.
Tell me how you really feel, Ambassador.
I tend to be very straightforward about things and to tell people what I think. I mean, you know, Washington was a different universe. I come from Illinois, and I always thought that, you know, obviously the Chicago was the epicenter of the world. And so it was an adjustment, really, for me to understand the kabuki that Washington requires. That is to say, how people interpret things is different than how they are interpreted here at the local level here in Chicago. And that was a learning experience for me. I'm glad I came through it and survived with at least my life intact. And so
hopefully more. Yes, exactly.
Yes, yes, yes.
And Ambassador, you were the first, along with Senator Barbara Mikulski, the first woman to wear pants on the Senate floor. Can you take us back to that day?
I can. And here's the thing, you know, what's that? Ignorance is bliss. I mean, I went to the Senate floor not knowing there was this unwritten rule that women had to wear dresses. I didn't know. I had thought I was looking kind of sharp that day. I had on a pantsuit and it was matched and I thought it looked really nice. And it caused this great stir when I went to vote. And I had no idea what was going on. Then some of the women staffers came to me and said, well, we told them that if the senators can wear pants, then so should we. So it was like, okay, a breakthrough. So I was really happy about the outcomes from that. But it was not like I intended to wear pants to make a statement. I was just, you know, going to work.
Just going to work and suddenly it happens. And you also ran for president in 2004. I'm wondering, what was the reaction then? We saw a very powerful reaction to the Hillary Clinton's candidacy, obviously. We saw a very powerful reaction to Geraldine Ferraro's candidacy from when I was a kid. So what was the reaction in Washington then? Did things change for you when you ran for president?
Well, they did. On the one hand, in the country generally, I thought I was being very well received and treated very nicely. I was always really impressed when fathers would bring. I had one guy brought his daughter and said he just wanted her to see that a woman could run for president and that it was okay. My little niece actually had inspired me. She said, "But Auntie Carol, all the presidents are boys," and she was 11 at the time. And I said, "Oh, sweetie, girls can be president too." And then I went out and talked to her father, and my brother said, "What's the matter?" I said, "I just lied to Claire." He said, "What do you mean you lied?" I said, "I told her girls can be president too." He said, "So what are you going to do about it?" I said, "Well, I'm going to run." So that was kind of one of the things that got me over the threshold with that particular campaign. In Washington, there were those who said I was delusional. I mean, they knew I'm not a gazillionaire. I didn't have millions of dollars to put into a presidential campaign. It was truly a grassroots kind of effort. And one thing I have subsequently learned is that there's no such thing as a grassroots presidential campaign. You really have to have the resources to win. But it was a very positive thing for me in the end. I worked myself into pneumonia, but other than that, it was a good thing, and I'm glad I did it.
But Ambassador, why do you think this is? I mean, I feel like you were experiencing the Anita Hill trial. You know, hearings inspired you to run for office. And I'm watching them myself and thinking, we haven't come that far if we're still here today. Why do you think the message to women in Washington is still so fraught?
Well, again, we're looking at change, which, of course, is the thing that happens in life more than anything else. And some people, Washington is essentially a conservative place, conservative in the old-fashioned sense of the word. So it's resistant to change. So change hasn't really happened as much as some of us would have expected or hoped, but it is happening. And so I want to be optimistic and positive about this. The change is happening. It may be incremental and slow, too slow for people like me. I'd like to see, you know, half and half. I'd like to see women elected across the board. But if that hasn't happened yet. But it will. And so I think particularly as young women come along, they are not content to be relegated to the sidelines or to the ladies' chambers. They expect to be able to participate in governance just like anybody else. They expect, in the words, the immortal words of the late Aretha Franklin, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. So that really, at the end of the day, is what it is that we're looking at. And I think that the politicians who, at the end of the day, every politician follows where they think the voters are. And so they will make the changes, and the process, the parties will change in response to what these, you know, what women want.
And I wanted to get a second voice in here. Cheryl Gay Stolberg is another observer of the inside world of Washington. She's a congressional correspondent in D.C. for The New York Times, where she's been for more than two decades. Cheryl, first to you, what were your early days like in the Capitol as a reporter?
Well, I didn't arrive in Washington until 1996, and I actually worked for the Los Angeles Times then. And in the mornings, every once in a while, we would do these C-SPAN roundtable breakfasts, and they would film in our bureau. And I remember that there were so few women in the bureau that they had to strategically place us around the table so that it didn't look like the whole place was full of men. And the whole place really was full of men. And that was really reflected, as you well know, in the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings, where Anita Hill, an African-American woman, found herself staring across the dais at an all-white, all-male judiciary committee. And, you know, some things have changed in Washington, but frankly, not a lot.
And Cheryl, that's a perfect segue for one of the questions I was going to ask, because I was also watching the hearings myself. Again, I was in high school when Anita Hill was the Anita Hill hearings were happening. And when both of you watch what's happening today and you compare it to what happened in 1991, how does that make you feel, Ambassador?
I'll be honest, there has been change. And this has been 20, 25 years now since I was in the Senate and the Anita Hill hearings happened. But there has been change, and I like to think that it's been positive change. On the one hand, or in the first place, the Democratic side of the Judiciary Committee is a lot more diverse now than it was then. The Republicans, unfortunately, still have that problem. I mean, they had to go out and hire a woman to come in and stand in just to be a female face for them. And I've suggested that they really need to consider supporting Republican women so they can have some diversity in that caucus and not have these all-male panels, whether it's on judiciary or on finance. I mean, it makes a difference having a woman at the table and in the room. It makes a difference in the conversation and what gets observed and how things get interpreted. So I'm hopeful that that the change will continue in the direction of inclusion of women. We are citizens of this great country. We are half the population, and there's no reason why we shouldn't participate in policy making for our country.
And Cheryl, you've written about the reasons that harassment can flourish in politics. Tell us a little bit about what you found.
One reason that harassment can flourish in politics is because political organizations, unlike businesses, revolve around a single person. And it's a person who, if they leave, the whole operation ceases to exist, right? Like if you have a company and your CEO gets fired, well, you get a new CEO and the company still goes on making widgets. But if you're in a political office and somebody makes a claim against, say, the senator or the congressman and they go, everybody loses their jobs. And that's one reason that women are, and men who get harassed, are really reluctant to report harassment. And also, as we know, Washington is this culture where, you know, lawmakers come and they're away from their families. And, you know, it's a kind of a very compressed situation where people are working very closely together intensely for long periods of time. And you've got these members who are far from home and, you know, up while the cat's away sort of thing. So those are a couple of reasons why harassment persists in politics, perhaps even to a greater degree than in the rest of American life.
And I'm curious, Cheryl, you said, you know, at some of these C-SPAN meetings, there were almost, you know, there were very few women at the table. I'm wondering how emblematic is that of a cultural issue within Washington, D.C.? I mean, we hear lots about the old boys club. I'm curious, who's in it? What power does it have? How much of this old boys club is sort of defined by things like fraternities, like elite schooling, and really money?
I think the ambassador actually had a correct point. Things have changed in Washington, but in a lopsided way. So on the Democratic side, we have more women and more people of color represented in Congress and the halls of power. But on the Republican side, not so much. In the Senate Judiciary Committee, all the 11 Republican members are male. And you do still see people rising up through the ranks of Washington like Brett Kavanaugh. He is really a creature of this sort of elite kind of Washington insider, you know, prep school culture. His father was a lobbyist. He lives in Chevy Chase, which is a very exclusive kind of wealthy suburb of Washington, or at least that's where he grew up. And he kind of methodically rose through the ranks, you know, worked for the Bush v. Gore team in Florida. He worked for the Bush White House. Then he, you know, became a judge. And in fact, it's kind of interesting. Mitch McConnell, the majority leader, worried about this. He thought that Kavanaugh's long career in Washington and also his lengthy record as a judge would be a problem in getting him confirmed. And I think he was kind of right. So maybe it's not always an advantage to be part of the old boy culture.
Ambassador.
I would point out this is not a partisan issue. It's not. The difference between the Republican and the Democratic sides of the aisle is obvious to anybody who's paying attention. But it's not a partisan issue. It goes to the heart of what a democracy is supposed to be. Democracy means bottoms up governance, that the people have something to say about who makes the rules for their lives. And by the people, that's supposed to mean everybody, particularly at this point. When the Constitution was first written, I was not included. Black people were not included. Women were not included. You know, blacks were 3/5 of a person, frankly. But that changed over time. And now we're at the point where I think women are beginning to say, we want to participate on an equal footing with the men. We don't see any reason why we're being excluded from this, in this environment in which the rules are made. And that, at the end of the day, this, the Supreme Court nomination is a lifetime appointment to the highest court in the land. The women should have an equal right to say what they think about that appointment, about the nominees, what they think about the process, and have as much input as anybody else, because they will be affected onto the next generation by whatever decisions the Supreme Court makes. And so I just think that that's why these things are so important and why it should not be a rush to judgment. There ought to be a considered approach, a considered analysis of the nominees, not only credentials, but capability and character.
Ambassador Carol Moseley Braun is a former U.S. Senator from Illinois and the first female African-American U.S. Senator. And Cheryl Gay Stolberg is a congressional correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks to you both.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.
When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
All this week on The Takeaway, we've been looking at what life is like for people after they leave prison. And today, the story of a man who's lived this transition and now shepherds others through it, too.
Good evening, everybody.
Hey!
It's good to be back.
See you there, everybody.
Stanley Richards is the executive vice president of the Fortune Society, which is based here in New York City. The Fortune Society provides housing, counseling, job training, and other services to help people get back on their feet after they're released from prison. Each week, Stanley leads a large communal meeting at the group's housing facility in Upper Manhattan. There, people can talk about their struggles and their successes transitioning to life on the outside. Frequently, that means discussing how to manage emotions like anger and avoiding behavior that could get you thrown right back into prison. To counsel those who are struggling, Stanley draws heavily from his own life.
When those situations happen, you almost got to freeze it in your mind, here and in your emotional mind, and say, what is going on? And for me, when I realized being hurt, being able to articulate that I'm hurt. It was, I was feeling it and I was responding to it, and I had a lot of energy and anger around it, but I wasn't able to articulate it. But once I identified it and I was able to articulate it, then I no longer needed to express myself through violence. I no longer needed to use my aggression to define who I am and how I respond to situations.
I sat down with Stanley to talk more about how his own experience has informed his work with the Fortune Society.
I was born and raised in Soundview in the Bronx in the projects. And every day all I seen and all I heard was messages about who I was, right? I was a young black man who was going to either end up in jail or end up dead. And what I did end up is in jail. And so I thought that that's what my life was going to be about. And I learned how to live that life. So I stayed on the streets. I cycled in and out of jail, in and out of Rikers. And my last incarceration, where I was sentenced to 9 years, I did 4.5 years. When I went to prison, I went to school and I got my GED. And then I started questioning all of the messages I got, because I thought I was dumb. I thought I couldn't have a life. And when I got my GED, it said, no, you're not that person. Then somebody encouraged me to go to college, and I went to college. And I realized that the messages that I was getting, the life that I was living, was all wrong. That is not who I am. So I realized at that time that my life was in my hand and that I could change it if given just the opportunity. So I came home with the idea of getting a job and changing my life. And when I came home, I started applying for these jobs. Nobody would give me an opportunity. Everybody said you had to have experience. I never got frustrated in the point that I gave up on myself. I just kept trying. And Fortune was the organization that hired me as a counselor in 1991. And that's where I started, and I stayed there until about 97. I went and I worked at Hunter College for a number of years. And then I came back to Fortune in 2001 as a senior director. And today I'm the executive vice president.
So we talked a little bit about the Fortune Society. What is the broader mission? What is it that you all are really trying to get done?
Well, our mission is twofold. One is to provide a safety net for men and women coming home from prison pretty much after much of the damage has been done. People don't have the ability to trust because trusting and vulnerability in prison will get you hurt, could get you killed. So what people end up learning are the behaviors that you can survive in prison on, but those behaviors will not allow you to survive in the community. But we help people rebuild their life through services. And we offer a range of services: housing, employment, substance abuse treatment, mental health treatment, family reunification. Any service that people will need, they can have under one roof to rebuild their life. Then we provide off-ramps for people so we can divert people from going through the damage of the criminal justice system. And then the third part of our mission is to change the policies that chew up so many people in the criminal justice system. We feel like it is just not enough to be a safety net at the end of the system. We have to be doing some upstream work on the policies that involve and chew up so many black and brown people from hard hit communities.
When you think about, when you deal with this population that's coming out of prison, what are some of the things that rise to the top? Like, are there certain things that you see are most urgent for this population?
Absolutely. One of the things we've been seeing over the years has been housing. Housing is critical to someone's stability when they come home. Over 50% of the people who were released from New York State prison into New York City ended up in the New York City shelter system. What worse way to ensure someone's return to prison than, after serving time, say that they have to go and live in a New York City shelter and they have to find a job and they have to rebuild their lives? We just think that that policy is not a policy that makes sense.
So I'm struggling with, with this idea that someone will pay their, dues to society, if you will be incarcerated, they will serve their sentence, they'll come out, and yet there seems to be a long tail of punitiveness that kind of takes you throughout, your reentry phase. Like, it's not enough to have served the time. Why aren't we doing more at the federal level? I mean, I think what you guys are doing at the Fortune Society is great. Yeah. I hear lots of other organizations doing things, but why isn't this more embedded into our society that folks need a pathway out?
You know, that's a great question, and that's part of what Fortune Society is doing is advocating and putting a face on this issue. Because we think that it's easy to sort of otherize people, to put them to the side. It doesn't really impact me if you don't have a face on it, if you hear it in the news or you read it in the papers or you hear it in conversation. So part of what we do is put a face on it. Because we have a saying that we say at Fortune is that we see the beauty in people before they see it in themselves. And I think for us as a country, we tend to not see beauty in people. We see all the bad that they do. We see all the damage that they do. But we don't see the beauty in each other. And as a country, the moment we stop saying, that's someone else, it doesn't really apply to me, and we see people as human, as someone who could be my neighbor, who could be my family member, and we ought to be giving them second chances like most people got, then we can change this dialogue and we can change how and the way we work with criminal justice and reentry. But we're a long way from there. We don't see people for who they are. We see them for what they did.
Stanley Richards, Executive Vice President of the Fortune Society. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
This is Jason. I'm calling from Gainesville, Florida. I spent a year in prison for statutory rape. And the hardest thing about getting out was other people thinking because you're a sex offender that you're a pedophile. And it took nearly a decade for people to start realizing that I was just another guy who was just trying to live and work. And even then, there's still people who refuse to accept that I'm a decent human being.
My name is Will. I spent 2.5 years at the South Carolina Department of Corrections. The biggest obstacle whenever people get out is that they can legally be discriminated against for almost all services.
My name is Reese from Grand Prairie. And when I got out of prison, the hardest thing that I encountered was finding a job. I had to go through the Texas Workforce Commission and complete at least 10 job interviews a week, but nobody wanted to hire a convicted felon who was on parole and was going to have to take half a day off every week to report to the parole. It took me 3.5 months to find a job. When somebody finally did grant me an interview, they gave me the job, and as of next month, I've been there for 10 years.
Hi, this is Lem calling from New York. The hardest part when I first came home was feeling like people on the street could look at me and tell that I was an ex-convict. I felt judged by complete strangers and was being treated less than because of my status.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.